debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple things I wanted to talk to you about and just kind of kick around. I have opinions on these things, but not certainties. But the first is a comment that Bernie Sanders made that really got me thinking. He was speaking with, as I recall, Rachel Maddow. It might have been Chris Hayes, might have been somebody else. But he was asked, okay, if Manchin has blown this thing up, the Build Back Better bill, then what are you going to do? And Bernie just came right out with both barrels. I mean, you know, first off, he said what he has said before publicly on a couple of occasions. You know, the Manchin's going to have to explain to the senior citizens of West Virginia why they can't have hearing aids and dental help. And he's going to have to explain to the young families of West Virginia why they can't have the child tax credit and why they can't get inexpensive daycare and education for their kids and stuff like that. You know, he went through that list. But then he said, we're just going to have to elect, this is not an exact quote, I'm doing this from memory, I'm just paraphrasing here. He said, put it up or down for a vote in January, right? In 2 weeks, basically, when the Senate is back together, put this thing on the floor for a vote. And if Manchin is still voting against it, if he votes no with the Republicans, then we head for the 2022 election. In other words, make this an issue in the 2022 election. Hey, progressives, if you actually want to see the stuff in Build Back Better, if you actually want to see a $500 billion challenge to climate change that's going to change the nature of the electricity that we, you know, of electricity generation in the United States, if you actually want to see people no longer encumbered with massive student debt, if you want to, that may have already been removed from it, but I'm not certain that, you know, if you want to see, you know, the list. Basically, that what we should do is go out in the 2022 election and say it's time to elect more Democrats to the Senate and use that failure of Joe Manchin to get Joe Biden's legislation passed. Use that as the lever, as the wedge, as the tool, as the campaign issue, as the talking point to challenge Republicans who are running for the Senate. We don't know yet if Chuck Grassley's going to run again, but odds are slim that he will. In Ohio, Rob Portman is not running for re-election, another Republican senator. In Pennsylvania, the Republican senator, his name is escaping me, but he's not running for re-election. I mean, there's a number of Republican seats that could be toss-ups as we go into this election. Now, I get there's a couple of Democratic seats, too. Warnock's down in Georgia's, but, you know, probably at the top of that list where, you know, we need to be helping these folks out. But Bernie wasn't saying, you know, if this thing fails, it will help us win elections in 2022. But I'm wondering if that might be the case. Again, and you know, if you're a longtime listener to this program, you know that I'm an optimist. I'm always trying to, you know, Reagan's old joke, you know, I know there's a pony in here somewhere. I'm always trying to find the, try to make lemonade out of lemons. But, hey, if this is the situation we have, if we've got a couple of Democratic senators, Manchin and Sinema, and in this case specifically Manchin, although Sinema seems to be in on it with him, and taking money from right-wing billionaires along with him, if we've got a couple of Democratic senators who are going to vote with Republicans, we need to get more Democratic senators who will not vote with Republicans, but who will vote with the American people. And that seems like a hell of a rallying cry for 2022. I mean, basically, the sales pitch for 2022 for Democrats is either going to be, look at the great stuff we did, elect us and we'll do more of it, which, you know, is the kind of momentum message. Don't stop us now. We're on a roll. Well, sometimes that works against you. It activates the other side. It gets the Republicans to come out and go, oh, no, you know, we don't want those seniors to have dental care. Oh, no, we don't want young families to have child tax credits that are paid for by taxes on billionaires. Are you kidding? We don't want Medicare to be expanded. Are you nuts? We want, you know, the health insurance companies are making contributions to us. So sometimes when you're on a roll, it actually works to your detriment politically. Yes, the people who are on your side are all enthusiastic, but they also figure, hey, they're on a roll. I don't need to show up and vote. They're doing just fine. Whereas if what you're, you know, if you can have some significant accomplishments, and Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress have had some really significant accomplishments. Between the American Rescue Act back in June of this year and the so-called BIF, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Plan or framework, I guess, is what the F and BIF stands for. Those two pieces of legislation are very consequential. You already have Republicans running on the outcome of the election, those pieces of legislation that they voted against. So going to the voters in 2022 and saying, hey, we got some good stuff done, but we also tried to do some really cool stuff and we got stymied by, you know, we just need a couple more senators. We need a couple of genuine progressives in the United States Senate on the Democratic side. So help us get them. I think that, you know, when you look at the math of politics, that actually, as terrible as this is in this moment, and this assumes, of course, that they're not going to work out a compromise. And frankly, I think they will. I think that there will probably be a $1.5 trillion, maybe even a $1.7 trillion bill. But, you know, keep in mind, the Build Back Better bill was originally $6 trillion over 10 years, $600 billion a year. And now it's $1.7 trillion. It went from 6 to 4 to 3.5 to 3 to 2.5. Each time, by the way, because Joe Manchin was squealing. And now it's down at $1.7 trillion. So I'm guessing that they're going to work out some kind of a compromise. Manchin is either going to, you know, leave the party, become an independent, and probably continue to caucus with the Democrats as long as they're in control. Or he's going to come around. He's going to say, you know, I'm not going to abandon the Democratic Party. So I could build a case either way, that we can win if we message correctly on a loss, or we can win if we message correctly on momentum. What I'm not willing to do is be in despair because Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are not helping out on this or on voting rights or anything else, because I think that all of these things are still on the table. And hopefully we'll continue to be after the election. Hopefully we'll be resolved before the election. If not, after the election. Hopefully Democrats will still have enough power that they can pass these things. I get it. The conventional wisdom is we're going to lose the House. And that's likely, largely because of gerrymandering, by the way. But the Senate, I think, is a toss-up right now. So, you know, where do we go with this? I don't know. But anyhow, those are my thoughts on all that. I just, you know, wanted to get it out there. And I wanted to share some takeaways from that with you, and then I'll pick up your phone calls right after this. So stick around here on the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about it. Susan in Seattle. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi. I have a couple of comments. Don't forget, there's a White House comment line that you can leave messages for the president.
Is that running again? Because it was shut down during the Trump administration. It used to be 202-456-1111.
Yeah, it is running. Right now it's closed for the holidays, but it's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I believe.
I see.
That they're open, and you can also whitehouse.gov/comment, leave messages.
Yep.
Secondly, Biden, when he became president, appointed Manchin's wife to the Appalachian Council, which I think is to develop business investment in the Appalachian region.
Mm-hmm.
If he's not going to support voting rights and he's not going to support Build Back Better, maybe she ought to be asked to resign from the council.
She does serve at the will
of the president.
No, I get that, Susan. But, you know, the punitive kind of stuff is what will cause Manchin to leave the party. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't recommend that.
And the other thing is that he has been shopping for a book agent so he can come out with a book about himself.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You know, the guy's got an ego that's 8 feet wide. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. And the other group I would suggest that we keep a very strong eye on is the House caucus called the New Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The other day, their chairman of their group said that we ought to pare down Build Back Better and just focus on a couple of things and not the whole...
Well, the New Democrats are the leftovers from Bill Clinton's New Democrat coalition, which are the leftovers from Bill Clinton and Al Fromm's DLC, which is the leftover from their attempt to go Reagan light, basically. You know, because back in 92, Reagan was actually popular, and so the Democrats were trying to be Reagan light. I think they're a dying breed, frankly, but I agree. We need to keep an eye on them. And the so-called corporate problem solvers, the Josh Gottheimers and Kurt Schraders of the world who call themselves, we solve problems for corporations here in Congress.
Yeah.
You know, these are sort of like the, you know, the Yellow Dog Caucus, too. I mean, there's a bunch of them, but I really think that history is passing them by very quickly. Susan, thank you. Excellent points all. I appreciate
them.
It. Thank you. Pauline in Los Angeles. Hey, Pauline, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I really liked what you said about what Bernie said about going for the Senate and making this next election about going after the Republicans instead of trying to have it be, the, like you said, the momentum strategy.
Right.
Anyways, but in light of that, I think the first things that Democrats and Biden needs to do is just be ready to make a deal with Manchin and prioritize voting rights and maybe have to sacrifice medical parts of the bill. And right now, also, Biden needs to stop paying hospitals to treat non-vaccinated COVID cases and start making, you know, the financial burden be there and insurance companies. That'll make a lot of people just get it, and because a lot of people are going to be that are vaccinated are going to be suffering if they can't get medical service. And then that leads again, like I said, to the medical issues of going to like Bernie Sanders' strategy and activating another grassroots strategy about single-payer networking states to go around the Congress and get a single-payer plan. Like you said, mass public, national public awareness, and get it going so that people are talking about it, people are angry, they want it, and that maybe blue states will start to network on their own to develop some type of their own single-payer plan. And even though that sounds really complicated, if it becomes like a grassroots talking thing that blue states are mad that we're paying a lot of taxes, we're supporting red states, and we're not getting anything. The red states are holding us up. You know, if the blue states start to get organized and at least try to get it out there that we want our own network of single-payer plan, get that out into the public national discourse.
Two thoughts on what you've said so far, Pauline, and I'm looking at the clock here. It's coming up on us. First off, you said stop paying hospitals for dealing with unvaccinated people. I believe that that was in the original American Recovery Act, I think, from when Trump was president, the one that the Democrats pushed through Congress and the Republicans let them do it, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they're backstopping hospitals. But I don't know any of the details of it. Was that time limited? Was there was it at the discretion of the executive branch, whether it gets paid or not?
I that's what I don't know either. But I think that they need to try to do that because they need to start to, you know, make people, you know, we like Republicans, how will Republicans fight that either? Because they're always saying that we're spending too much money and we have to control the debt.
Right.
So that would work to our advantage to say, yeah, well, if we're not going to get what we want out of
I'm with you.
We need to start conserving
money. And my
money.
Second point is that Ro Khanna has introduced legislation, Congressman Ro Khanna has introduced legislation that would allow states that go single payer, like California wants to, Vermont tried to have access to Medicare and Medicaid money. Because right now they can't use that money for a single payer plan. It's called the state waiver. And we really need to be pushing that legislation that Khanna has.
Yeah, that's one. But we need to also network with other blue states to get it to be a
I'm with you. We need to stop we need to push legislation called the End Red State Welfare Bill. Pauline, thank you.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Earlier, somebody called about CNN freaking out about 23 Democrats not seeking re-election. Yeah, okay. I am not panicking. I'm sorry. I'm over it. I'm not panicking. So, picking up your phone calls, Becky in New Berwick, Maine. Hey, Becky, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
I just wanted to add to the conversation because the first thing I thought of after the Build Back Better was reported as dead was, oh, my God, they're going to get back in. And what happens to us when fascism takes over? I mean, I think that's a pretty good motivator for getting people out to vote.
And I think we saw that in 2020.
Right. But I think you're going to have a lot of apathy if, you know, if nothing passes. There were, you know, all these promises made, you know, just I'll always vote. But just for myself, I was hoping that the Medicare age would at least be lowered if we can't get single payer. And that's not going to happen. But all those young people that were expecting their loans to be forgiven, I'm just like, you know, like I said to my husband, what are they going to do? Are they going to be able to just raid our Social Security and our pension plans and just take everything? I mean,
that's what they did in Chile.
Yeah, well, what does that look like? I mean, am I going to get shot going in my mailbox because I had a Biden sign up, you know, the last election? I mean, I think you do hear the Republicans using socialism, communism all the time, and it seems to be a motivator for their that side. But I mean, we're looking at a real chance of having fascism.
I agree, Becky, but I think it's a somewhat different issue about, you know, from, or I'd like to decouple it from the discussion of Build Back Better. You can build a strong argument that if Build Back Better gets passed, it makes everybody happy with the Democrats and lots of cool stuff happens and we start winning elections in larger ways than we are right now. You can also build an argument that if a couple of obstructionists, conservative Democrats, along with all the Republicans, block something really cool from happening, that that'll piss off people enough that they will show up at the polls. You know, a lot of people are motivated by being angry about things rather than being happy with things. In fact, when some of the times that we have the lowest voter turnouts are when people feel like, hey, everything's good, I don't have to show up. And so I think you could build a case that if we pass it and we message it right, then we'll get reelected. If it doesn't get passed and we message that right, and we message it right is the critical part of both of those, and we message it right, then that opens opportunities for us in 2022 in those elections. We'll see. But
I just wanted to mention also that Val Demings is also running, and Tim Ryan are running for Senate as well.
Yes, and they're both brilliant. They're great, great members of Congress. Becky, thank you.
Today we're reading from Ralph Nader's new book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, a fable. It's fiction. Chapter 1, Invader. It was one of those uncomfortable morning strategy sessions with his senior staff. For House Speaker Reginald Blamer, the discomfort was in having to figure ways to continue blocking a long overdue raise in the federal minimum wage for many millions of low-income workers when he knew in his gut it was not the right thing to do. We're in the crosshairs, he would say, starting such congressional meetings in his spacious office. Not that his anxiety would cause him to renege on the implicit promise he had made to the big boys to stop the move in Congress to raise the minimum. But there was still background anxiety. After all, politicians are only human, and like many, Speaker Blamer came from a large family that had lived through tightened circumstances. His father was a tavern keeper and his mother a seamstress. Deep anxiety, however, did have one inherent comfort at such morning gatherings. It tended to work in mysterious ways to overcome his morning constipation, the constant bane of the speaker's existence. Holding down 30 million workers, including among them many conservative voters, who, when adjusted for inflation, were making less today than workers in 1968, bothered the very private, self-censored, psychosomatic recesses of the speaker's conscience. And so, not surprisingly, Speaker Blamer felt the onset of a solid bowel movement. He excused himself and repaired to his large private bathroom. As he sat down in the broad porcelain, the speaker heard a sound inside the toilet. Lifting himself up a bit, he looked down and saw the head of a mostly submerged black rat closely eyeing his bottom. Yow, 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 bellowed the speaker as he straightened up and slammed the cover down. Alarmed, the staff rushed to the bathroom door to respectfully call, Speaker Blamer, are you all right? Do you need help? They dared not open the door. The speaker did not tolerate any exposure of his privacy, especially being seen in his corpulent native suit. Another more normal person might have replied, yeah, I'm okay, it's just that there's a rat in the toilet bowl. But Speaker Blamer was not a normal person. He has had to be super cunning to get to his present situation in life. Being cunning means that you can instantly sense danger, being as alert as, say, a rat. And Speaker Blamer was already imagining the deriding headlines in the late night show jokes if he disclosed what really prompted his impulsive cries of sheer terror as he leapt from the throne. So he replied, nothing much, boys, just one of those sudden spasms I get once in a while. Sure comes on fast, it goes away fast, too. I'll be right out. Rejoining the staff at the head of the conference table, albeit full of gas and undischarged wastes, the speaker went through the checklist for crushing the hopes of the downtrodden multitudes. His chief of staff reviewed the usual elements of the campaign against workers. First off, the speaker will say, I always thought that if you raise the price of anything, you get less of it. The proposal to raise the minimum wage is a job killer. Good soundbite, said his research assistant. The speaker nodded gravely, though when he heard the word bite, he silently winced. The operations assistant counted off the usual reliable economics professors who could supply objective warnings about losses of jobs and recession. The Fast Food and Big Box Retailer Association had begun a large ad buy on television and radio with the announcer's stentorian voices of dire gravity. The K Street lobbyists were already in action on Capitol Hill, marshaling the corporate PACs to make sure this drive was on the front burner, hinting to legislators that their employers might see this as a litmus test for their donations. Top eds, letters to the editors, and editorial condemnation of economically disruptive higher wages and layoffs was already in the pipeline. About to burst, the speaker could not wait to end the meeting. Okay, fellows, you seem to have the situation well in hand. It's not the first time we had to fight off this wage grab. Get to work. They all scattered, including an irrelevant intern who wondered to herself whether paying members of Congress more would mean the government would end up with less of them. The moment the door to his spacious office closed, the speaker literally lunged to his private toilet. Before he could enjoy a moment of quiet satisfaction, a shrill shriek lifted him up as his eyes bulged. It was the black rat swimming in the bowl, propelling the terrified cry, "Yow, yow, yow." Again, he slammed down the toilet seat. His longtime secretary heard his yell and rushed to his bathroom. "Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, what happened? Are you okay?" Recovering his composure, he replied, "I'm okay, Sarah, just more of those sudden spasms. I've got to get some physical therapy. By the way, did you schedule that fundraiser next week for an hour later?" "Yes, I did, Mr. Speaker," Sarah replied, sounding very relieved. Arriving home that early evening, he sat down to a healthy diet supper prepared by his adoring wife, Regina. Their three children were grown up living in distant states, so they were empty nesters. "You seem unusually agitated, honey," said Regina. "Did you have a hard day?" "It seems every day is hard in these times," he replied, shrugging off her concern. "What a great meal always, Regina. Now I need some relaxing reading. Do you know where we put that colorful book of animals that we got as a wedding anniversary gift years ago?" "Why, yes, Reginald. It came in three volumes, Mammals, Reptiles, and Insects. Tell me which one you want and I'll get it for you." "Mammals," he replied. Sitting in his study, the speaker started reading about the rat. The word rat is derived from the Latin rodere, which means to gnaw. Rats produce litter several times a year with high infant mortality. If seen as weak, newborns are eaten by their parents and their stronger siblings. Over the centuries, rats have developed uncanny abilities to survive dangers everywhere, especially those produced by their close proximity to humans, whose detritus and garbage ironically provide the means by which they prosper and create new nests. Rats live everywhere, underground, in sewers and buildings, etc. From Ralph Nader's new book, How the Rats Reformed the Congress, a fable.
The Tom Hartman program, and Sam in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Sam, what's on your mind today? Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too.
Thank you.
When you were talking earlier about, you know, taking a vote so that everybody can see how everybody's voting, but you also mentioned the fact that we need to do what we can to have the reporters put microphones in the face of the Republicans as they're doing with Democrats and always in Manchin's face. You know, what kind of advice can you give, you know, like a 73-year-old Democratic, here in Arizona, you know, trying to, I make calls for the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Good on you.
During the election time. Mm-hmm. But what can I do now in this laid-back period to get the press to get in the face of Republicans? Is there anything that, you know, that...
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam, and thank you for asking it, because I probably wouldn't have spontaneously just thought to say this, but it's really important. Almost everybody in the media, the reporters that you see on TV, and in particular what you want to focus on are the ones who you see doing the interviews with members of Congress in Congress, the individual reporter. So here's Joe Blow or Sally Blow standing there, you know, with a microphone in the face of some senator. And on the screen, it will give that person's name and sometimes their Twitter handle. And Twitter is probably the most effective tool for this. So what you do is you go on Twitter, you find their account, you follow them, and then you send them a tweet specifically to them. Put a little period right in front of their name of the at Joe Blow. You know, put a little period in front of it so everybody can see your message. But they will receive it and on Twitter and just say, why are you not asking Republicans why they are blocking hearing aids for elderly people? Or another one, why? And keep it to a single question, right? Another one, why are you not asking Republicans why they are blocking child tax credit for young families? Why are you not, you know, and just take these questions that are being thrown at Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and the occasionally when, like with drug prices, you know, Kurt Schrader here voted, you know, to keep drug prices high, basically, or it was the other way around. He refused to vote to lower them. So instead of, you know, asking Kurt Schrader about it, why aren't we asking the Republicans about it? You know, it's like the Republican members of Congress. So You would be astonished, Sam, how much influence individual tweets like that, particularly from a wide number of people, just seemingly randomly coming out of nowhere to actual on-the-ground reporters. These people, typically, they don't have a lot of followers. They do pay attention to when they are tweeted, and they are, as long as you're polite and you don't try to, you know, humiliate them or shame them, but, you know, instead you just try to provoke them to do something in a friendly way. They're human beings just like all the rest of us, and they do respond to it. And this is one of the few ways that all of us can directly pressure people in the media. You know, trying to get to the head of CBS is going to be a challenge. But getting to that reporter who is standing on the street in front of the White House, you can do that right now.
Okay.
How's that?
Thanks.
Thank you, Sam. And thank you for, you know, being one of those people who's out there making those phone calls. It's what you're doing is so very, very valuable. Thank you. Amy in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Amy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, longtime listener, first-time caller. How are you?
Well, thank you, Amy. Nice. I'm fine. Nice to hear from you. What's on your mind today?
I'm a longtime listener on Facebook, sir, and a lot of my friends there are pretty down. I wanted to bring up the fact that you went viral on Twitter over the weekend with the caller that was the anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, I saw it.
And it was epic, sir. And
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring a smile to my friends on Facebook and just wish everyone happy holidays and hope that they can. Maybe you guys should replay that video that went viral on TikTok and Twitter.
I'll
for
just,
friends that haven't seen it.
I'll just let it. It's all over the place, Amy. It really is. And thank you for the acknowledgement. And thank you for the holiday wishes. That was very kind of you. We all appreciate it. And let me tip my hat to Nate Atwell here in our studio, who our video director, who put that thing up on TikTok to begin with. And, you know, somebody apparently with some influence started promoting it. But, boy, it really went nuts.
Tip of the hat to Nate and tip of the hat to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. That's very kind of you. And happy holidays to you and your family. I wish you the very best. Thank you. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax. The way car buying should be.
Jessica in Chicago. Hey, Jessica, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Congratulations on your new book coming out.
You are
the most prolific author I know. Just amazing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. The country is so harsh and cruel right now that I'm doing a little kindness. And I see my newspaper delivery couple in the morning. They're a Hispanic couple. I see them at 6 in the morning. And one day, it's pouring rain, and the wife was in the back seat double bagging the papers. And I'm going to surprise them with a $50 tip.
Oh,
and my
great.
Mail carrier, too. It's just too harsh of a world. And I want to say, Joe the Grinch Manchin needs to grow a heart.
Amen. Amen. Yeah, and stop telling us that, you know, young couples who get child tax credit money will use it to buy drugs, and that if we give paid sick leave to people, that they will use it to go hunting and, you know, on their employer's dime. I mean, you know, come on. It's called projection. You know, he is suggesting that people who don't have means would do the kind of thing that he would do when he imagines himself in that situation, which is more of a comment on Joe Manchin than on anything else. Jessica, thank you. Thank you. And happy holidays to you. Richard in San Francisco. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Back at you.
Thank you. Something I've wondered about for a long time now, you know, if you think back about the way that Donald Trump used Twitter, I mean, you know, you just couldn't get rid of it. He was like every 5 seconds. Why isn't Joe Biden assigning a team of people just to put out tweets that highlight the various accomplishments and positions? Is essentially, he's left Twitter like in a closet somewhere as a tool to get the messaging out to all the Democrats, but in particular, the bully pulpit. You know, Trump wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Twitter, and yet I don't ever see tweets from Joe Biden. Once in a blue moon, there's something. You know, why do you think that is?
It's because of the algorithm, Richard. You have to understand the environment, which is the White House is tweeting regularly, constantly, and they're tweeting about their accomplishments. The thing is, Twitter and Facebook's algorithms favor, the language they use, the way they would say it is they favor engagement. And engagement means generally the type of engagement. In fact, one of the things we learned from the Twitter from the Facebook whistleblower was that being pissed off is 5 times more engaging than being happy. And the algorithm reflects that. The algorithm, you know, will give a pissed off tweet 5 times as much juice. It'll push it 5 times farther to, you know, 500% more people than it will a tweet that says, hey, we just accomplished something, a tweet that should just make people happy. So when Trump would go on and say something absurd or obscene or stupid or hateful, Twitter's algorithm would amplify it, and as would Facebook's, tremendously. And so everybody would see it. And the dynamic that you described, Richard, you can't get away from it. It's always in your face, would happen. When Joe Biden comes out and says, hey, you know, we just, you know, fill in the blank, right? We just saved the lives of 100,000 people by doing something. You know, people are like, oh, well, that's sweet. But it doesn't cause them to retweet it to 30 friends, go, I'm really pissed about this. And it's a problem. And frankly, I think that these algorithms need to be regulated by law because they're tearing our society apart.
Well, I don't disagree with you about the algorithms. I understand that actually fairly well. I guess what I'm saying is, even if you took the idea of pissing people off or of you know, coming up with something that makes people mad, there's plenty of things that people get mad about, like, you know, the fact that the voting rights issue has been just apparently tabled, you know, the fact that there's been no focus on the handful of Republicans that might actually go across the aisle to support voting wise.
Right.
You know, there's things, you know, I think what you're saying, which I'm not sure I agree with, is that the Biden administration doesn't have people who are creative enough to word tweets in such a way that they take advantage of the algorithms. I mean, you know,
that may be one thing that I'm saying, Richard. It wasn't what I had in my mind when I laid out that, but I would not disagree with that characterization. The Democratic Party has always been terrible on messaging, or at least since the 80s, and they need to get their act together. Richard, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Kevin in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Kevin, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Happy holidays and to you and your crew.
Thank you. Back at you.
Boy, I tell you, we're talking about how the Republicans are constantly going against Democrats and using derogatory remarks, communist Democrats type of stuff. And is that psychological warfare type of thing that, you know, enemies use to
yes
for propaganda
Absolutely.
Purpose.
In fact, that's that, a lot of the stuff that is heavily built into the advertising industry. And I'm real familiar with this industry. I started and built two ad agencies, and I used to teach advertising for the American Marketing Centers, traveled all around the country, taught advertising and marketing, have done work in-house and in seminars for every major branch of the American military, four different major, American intelligence services, et cetera, et cetera. And an awful lot of the psychology that is used in the advertising industry came out of World War I. Came out of Edward Bernays' research, the founder of public relations. He was Sigmund Freud's nephew. He's the guy Glenn Beck used to love to beat up on. And, because Woodrow Wilson hired him to basically sell us on World War I. And then those techniques found their way, made their way into advertising throughout the 30s and 40s and became a science in the 50s. And so, yes, the answer to your question.
And why aren't we reversing it? Confronting them, really throwing it right back in their face. I mean, we are supposedly intelligent individuals.
Yeah. It's a conversation I just had with Richard, Kevin. It's like, yes, the Democrats need to get their damn act together in this regard. They need to get their messaging act together. That said, they have this horrible disadvantage. There is a multi-billion dollar right-wing media infrastructure out there. Three different television networks, a company that owns over 200 television stations, 1,500 right-wing radio stations. Right-wing books are literally subsidized. If you're a right-winger and you write a book, it's going to sell, it's going to hit the New York Times bestseller list instantly because one of these giant right-wing foundations is going to buy 10,000 copies of it and boom, you're on the bestseller list. None of that exists on the left. Literally none of that exists on the left. I have never gotten a penny for doing this show from anybody outside of an advertiser, basically. Whereas Sean Hannity's show was getting $1 million a year from the Heritage Foundation. Rush Limbaugh was getting $2 million a year from the Heritage Foundation. It's like there's literally nothing like that right-wing infrastructure on the left. And frankly, it's not just the failure of Democrats to message. It's the failure of wealthy people within the Democratic Party. And I wrote an open letter to Tom Steyer about this 2 years ago and read it on the air. It's the failure of wealthy people inside the Democratic Party to realize the importance of media, of building a permanent progressive media infrastructure that can then work to the advantage of ultimately essentially control the Democratic Party. The reason the Republican Party got taken over by the Tea Party and now by the right-wing crazies is because the media pushed them in that direction. This creation that they created. Well, wouldn't it be great if progressives could do the same thing, only on the left? Kevin, I got to run, but thank you for the call. John in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Mr. Hartman, and happy holidays.
Thank you.
I was listening to what you were talking about, and when my family came to this country, they didn't have any jobs. They lived in Manhattan on Mulberry Street. That was kind of like what they call the Italian ghetto. And my family worked their way out of it by getting better jobs with a better education. The problem with most people in this country is we give away so much.
John, you are completely missing my point that we need to change the way we understand money. Money is energy. Money isn't just like, something the Treasury makes. Every country, every civilization, every culture, since the advent of agriculture, and even many hunting gathering societies, but not so much there. I mean, wampum typically was to tell stories and to record information more than for transactions. But ever since we started locking up food, which became the first form of money, money has represented life energy. Money represents literally the energy of our lives. And we need to think about it in that context. And Conrad Shaw's point was that whatever your cost of living is, and whether it exceeds your neighborhood or not, is irrelevant. Those are choices that you can make, where you want to live, what you want to do. And I get it that you think that our welfare programs are too generous. I respectfully say, screw you. Our welfare programs are nowhere near solid enough to catch people who are falling through the social safety net. And people are falling through
literally every day. We had here in the United States for 3 weeks the UN's expert, the special raconteur on poverty. And what he found was that in large chunks of the United States, severe poverty associated with poor health, toothlessness, you know, hunger, literally, malnutrition, is here in the United States, the richest country on earth. So my point was that we need to change how we think about money. That was just it. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Happy holidays.
Thanks. Happy New Year, Jesse. It's coming up anyway.
Yep. Hey, I hope it's a lot better than this past year. I think we could do it. You really key on talking about the way money is looked at and the need to be changed. The topic I want to talk to you about was you made the book The Crash of 16. Mm-hmm. I say you was right. I put it like this. Trump coup was to prevent the crash. So I'm trying to say that when you talk about tax, the system now is so desperate that the elites need to take direct control of the government so they could consume the taxes, because the private sector is bankrupt. It has no credibility. So when you say the taxes, money need to be looked at as different. I would put it this way. You can't separate politics and economics, because that's our problem. Doing that, they could get away with saying, well, you're free. Yeah. You could vote for whoever you want.
Well, and the extension,
but economically, that's different. You know, it's like it's separated. If the government could earn its own money, it wouldn't have to tax.
Well, in theory, I mean, it would debase the currency if the government simply issued money and used that to pay for things.
No, they would be in the market like the private sector. But the private sector has been Jim Crowing it from day one. The government has only allowed tolls, fees, and taxes. It can't get out there and build a bridge for itself.
Well, it can. It's the itself is us. I mean, government is us. That's the thing that most conservatives miss, is the first three words of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. We the people. It's us. You know, we the people create governments, among men and women.
We create wealth, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
We only allow the tax and fees and tolls. That's it.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Well, I don't think it's wrong. I think that there should be a separation between what is public space and what is private space. My concern, Jesse, is kind of the opposite. It's that we have privatized so much of government functions, including the military now, that rather than things being done on behalf of we the people, we have things being done on behalf of corporate profits. And it's skewing how these corporations, these contractors behave, and what they're doing. So, good point. Jesse, thank you. Alex in Utica, New York. Hey, Alex, what's on your mind today?
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I thought that if you plant trees and the nitrogen fixtures, fish ponds, and food forests that hold underground seas of water and perennial vegetables, and wood chips would give them fertility, and wood chips prevent fires in California, it would be better for them.
So you're advocating permaculture, basically.
Yeah, but if you take your tax deduction, you could reinvest in the land that you own around you.
Right.
And
it is, one of the more effective ways to sequester carbon is the way that nature has done it for 4 billion years on this planet, or arguably maybe 2 billion years on this planet. And that's through photosynthesis. It's through growing things. It's sequestering it in the soil, ultimately. And, I don't disagree. I think it's a great point, Alex. Thank you for calling and making it. Jeff in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Jeff, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's on your mind today?
Well, every time you mention Joe Manchin and his his little comment about afraid that the tax credit, child tax credit, is going to be used for buying drugs.
Right.
And I'm thinking in my mind, yeah, he may have something there. They're going to buy drugs like insulin, EpiPens, and other pharmaceuticals that they can't otherwise afford.
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it. And his daughter sold drugs. She's the one who tripled the price of EpiPens. So maybe he was thinking of that.
Yeah.
Maybe he was.
No, he wasn't thinking that, but I think that's a great retort. It's biting. It's satirical.
Yep.
It's something people should use more often as a little bit of satire. I mean, if you can't shame them, at least, you know, ridicule them into line.
Amen. Amen. Well done, Jeff. Thank you very much for that. Travis in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Travis, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just want to tell you something that no one is talking about right now. It's about a cult of personality. Who is going to be our Democratic personality? Because we have no one that can over-Trump Trump. Who is going to be that?
I think that we have a few good candidates. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is at the top of that list. Bernie Sanders. I think that Sheldon Whitehouse is a little too self-effacing. He's a humble guy. He's not quite enough of a, you know, I'm here in the public and I'm loving it. But he's got a lot to say too.
Tom,
pardon?
We have to fight fire with fire.
I agree.
We got to get an actor or someone who's very famous, and we got to get them in there and just plow this guy out.
Yeah, well, that's what we had kind of hoped Al Franken would do and be, you know, sadly, he got taken down. Travis, I think that there are rising stars inside the Democratic Party. The entire squad, basically, is really doing great, and I'm so happy.
They're only policy people. We have to have someone that has the Trump faction, you know what I mean? The faction of Trump and Trump over Trump. That's what we need.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, what
you
I mean
somebody
is
who will use obscenity and racism?
No. We have to have a cult of personality of liberalism and
right. We need, in other words, we need media stars. We need progressive media stars and who are elected officials. Yeah, I get it and I agree with you. Travis, thank you. Brian in Lake Worth, Florida. Hey Brian, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Tom. First I want to wish you and your family happy holidays.
Well, thank you. Back at you, Brian.
And secondly, has anyone ever done a survey or asked the people from West Virginia why they ever voted for him? And if they did, why?
And
I'm really curious about how they feel today. Are there any surveys like that out there?
That's a good question. I'll have to ask Troy Miller, my editor and friend and colleague, who lives in West Virginia. He writes a blog over on Substack.com. Troy really has his finger on the pulse of that state, and I haven't had that conversation with him in months, so I need to revisit it. I don't know the answer to the question, Brent. I just don't. I'm sorry. But it's a good one, and thanks for raising it and getting it on my radar screen. Gary in Alpharetta, Georgia. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today? Greed has no heart.
No, not ever.
Yep.
And I have to say it for the millionth time. This is the central core of our problems.
I agree.
Because it always comes back to money. It's sad. And I applaud you for being the optimist that you are. And I agree with that philosophy. I'm more, as you know, I'm an optimist up to a point. I'm more of a realist. And I'm not saying you don't recognize and respect reality. I think you do. That's just the difference in who we are. But I just don't think, and I hope I'm wrong, dead wrong. I just don't think this is a short-term movement.
What's this that you're talking about that you don't think is a short-term movement?
The Trumpster.
Oh, the fascist movement in the United States. No, it's been around forever. I mean, you know, it used to be called the Confederacy. It was very much a fascist movement. And then it was called America First in the 1930s, you know, when it was the we're fine with Hitler movement. And now here it is again. It's always been with it. It was used to be called the Klan.
It's always been with us. But never to this extent, Tom, this is not a functioning democracy as we know it. It's caused by there's more money out there. When you were growing
I get
up,
that there's more money, Gary, but I think that if you were black in the late 1890s or the early 1900s, the power of the fascist element in this country would have been far more visible than it is to white people now.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think we have a culture that can recognize the greater good on issues? I don't think we do.
I think we do. I think that it takes leadership. Bottom line. It takes leadership. Throughout my life, Gary, I have gone back and forth on this question. Do the times make the leaders, or do the leaders make the times? You know, this whole debate about the great man theory of history. You know, would these historical events happen if some other person had been the leader at the time, or would they not have happened? And the conclusion I've come to is it's 50-50. You know, sometimes there actually is a great leader. Franklin Roosevelt was one of them, who can change the nature of things. Napoleon, you know, people like that. And Hitler, for the worst, you know, but the same thing. And then sometimes the times just build up to a pressure point where pretty much anybody who steps into that is going to cause it to happen. Gary, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed by Robin Broad and John Cavanaugh. This is from the introduction. In late June 2009, the two of us received deeply disturbing news. Marcello Riviera had been disappeared. We had never met Marcello, but we had been looking forward to doing so. He and four other water defenders, as they would become known to many, were scheduled to travel to our city, Washington, D.C., to receive a human rights award. At that point, we had never been to Marcello's home country, much less to his hometown or the old house he was renovating. Nor did we have any plans of going there. To be honest, we didn't know the difference between a tortilla and a pupusa. For nearly 2 weeks, Marcello Rivera's family could not find him. Then, on June 29th, they received a phone call that they had been dreading. The anonymous caller was brief. There was a body in an old abandoned well just west of the Riviera hometown of San Ysidro Cabanas. The well was near the spot where Marcello had last been seen some 12 days earlier, getting off the bus at a turnoff to the capital city. During those 12 days, Marcello's family and friends had been at wit's end, searching frantically, desperately for him. They had spread news of his disappearance in all the barrios of San Ysidro and nearby towns. They had called the police for over a week to no avail. The Rivera family had even filed a formal complaint with El Salvador's attorney general, pleading for him to conduct a search and an investigation into Marcello's disappearance. But another poor person gone missing up in the rural north meant little to the authorities. After the anonymous tip to Marcello's family, the police finally acted. They pulled the remains of a body out of the dry 30-meter deep well. So extensive was the torture that the body was unrecognizable. The face was grotesquely disfigured. In the assessment of the coroner, the death had been caused by asphyxiation. The public prosecutor disagreed, concluding that the death had come from blows to the head. Whatever the case, the cause of death bore eerie similarity to that inflicted by right-wing death squads during the 12 years of El Salvador's gruesome civil war in the 1980 to 1992 period. Thus, Marcello Riviera became the first of several water defenders to be assassinated in the 21st century fight over mining in northern El Salvador. Though we never met Marcello, we've been haunted by him and the circumstances of his death ever since. Who killed Marcello, and why? Perhaps you know the difference between a tortilla and a pupusa. Or perhaps, like we had done, you are entering this story without a clue. Perhaps El Salvador is not even on your radar screen. Or perhaps El Salvador is on your radar screen only because of gangs or immigrants who trek north. But really, that doesn't matter. Certainly, on one level, this is a story about El Salvador. At the same time, it's not just about El Salvador. This is a David versus Goliath story about a battle between a country and a foreign mining company. But it's also about how global corporations, be they big gold or big pharma or big tobacco or big oil or big banks, move into poorer communities in countries all over the world. Marcello's story, before and after his murder, is about the struggle for clean and affordable water everywhere. It is also a story about workers and communities defending their air and land, their health and their climate, and their rights to defend themselves against corporate incursion. About how to prioritize those rights and the common good versus the usual prioritization of the profits of big corporations and their owners. It is certainly a story about gold and when and why we should leave it in the ground. But it could also be about coal or natural gas or other fossil fuels, about whether we measure progress in aggregate financial terms or through the well-being of people and the planet, about who gets to make the decisions that affect our lives. To say that this story is the water defenders versus big gold holds keys to reversing the outsized power of global corporations today is not an exaggeration. you may find yourself surprised by the relevance of the strategies of the water defenders in El Salvador. Whether your focus is on a Walmart in Washington, D.C., a fracking company trying to expand in Texas or Pennsylvania, or a petrochemical company outside New Orleans. Along the way, however cliched the quote attributed to Margaret Mead may have become, you may also find yourself inspired by a small group of thoughtful, concerned citizens who stand up to corporate power. We first heard of Marcello in May 2009, just a month before his murder. He was a 37-year-old teacher who directed his hometown's cultural center, an avid reader, a person who loved theater and the arts and a good practical joke. We heard his name because he was a leader of the main coalition of Salvadoran groups opposed to mining, the National Roundtable on Mining in El Salvador, or La Mesa. The roundtable was not well known outside of El Salvador, but we learned of it because the group had been chosen to receive a prestigious human rights award from the Institute for Policy Studies, where John works. In 2009, the Institute selected the roundtable to honor its opposition to mining companies eager to exploit the gold deposits near El Salvador's major river. On a warm night in October 2009, just months after Marcello's body was pulled from that well, hundreds gathered at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. to meet and applaud the Salvadoran water defenders. Among them was Marcello's youngest brother and best friend, Miguel. The book is The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed, by Robin Broad and John Cavanaugh. Welcome back, Brian in Joliet, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Happy holidays, Tom.
Thank you. You too, Brian.
Thank you. Well, you're 100% right what you were speaking of earlier today, and given certain political, social, economic conditions, world historical figures, like in 1933, we got the great man, President Roosevelt. Germany got the evil man, Hitler. And then I wanted to say that in 2007-2008, Air America, you, Rhodes, Malloy, people like that made a wonderful contribution to getting Obama elected over McCain.
You betcha.
And if that hadn't happened, we would have had a Great Depression. And if I may say, there was a great song, real popular hit by a group called The Fix, called One Thing Leads to Another. And the lyrics to this song are, to a certain extent, true and really relevant for what's going on today in the United States of America.
Yeah, well said, Brian. Thank you very much. And thanks for the confirmation that we are entering a progressive era. I appreciate that.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.